This mortal coil.
What impact should being born into great luck have on your outlook? This is the question we're pondering on This Mortal Coil tonight. It's the great gamble, isn't it? A throw of a dice. The fact that you were born at all leaves a lot to chance anyway. Maybe you were lucky. Maybe you were born into a loving family with a strong support network around you. Or maybe you've had less luck in your life, born into tougher circumstances. And it's often these circumstances at the beginning that can lead to a life of poverty that is handed through not only your life, but through multiple generations. My next guest tonight is asking the question, can we untether our life from the random game of chance? And what responsibility do those with more privilege have to those with less? Glyn Davis is the CEO of the Paul Ramsey Foundation, which works to end intergenerational poverty. And he's penned a book called On Life's Lottery. And Glyn joins us on Nightlife tonight. Welcome, Glyn.
Thank you very much. It's a delight to be here.
So, Glyn, I want to begin with your luck story. Do you consider yourself being born into luck?
Oh, very much so, because I was the eldest of three in a very loving family that cared about its children and made sure we got a good education and supported and encouraged us. And there is no better luck. There's no greater luck than choosing the right parents. And I'm deeply grateful to that and for my parents for that. But if you don't have that good fortune, and that's when it starts, a whole set of complications can follow and life can be a whole lot more difficult. And I think the test for all of us who've had fortunate lives is what have we done to help those who haven't?
When did you realise your life was a fortunate one, Glyn?
Growing up in the suburbs of Sydney, being able to go to a modestly good school, getting to university at a time when university education was free, which is one of those brief moments in history that was extraordinarily fortunate, and at a time when there were jobs to participate, jobs to look for and places to be.
Yeah.
There wasn't a moment. There isn't sort of this sudden realisation. It's just a sense of this is the world I'm fortunate enough to inhabit. And like lots of people, it took travel to see that the world wasn't like this. It took encounters with some Indigenous communities to realise that even in our country, there were people who weren't given these opportunities. And it, in a sense, it's life broadens you out. You begin to see that it isn't all like this. It's the patterns are much more varied. As a researcher, of course, I got particularly interested in what the research tells us. And it's sobering because it is so careful and considered and now longitudinal. We now have research data, thanks to the Melbourne Institute's HILDA survey, that goes back a generation. And we can actually look at how people who were poor in the 1980s and 90s have got on in the 2020s. And what it tells you really clearly is that the longer you spend in poverty in childhood, the less your chances of breaking through to a fortunate life are in adulthood. And you've got to say, how is that fair?
Mm. Do you think overall, generally, Australia is a lucky country?
It's the phrase that was framed by Donald Horne, the lucky country, who was also my honours supervisor. So I actually got to spend some time with him and to talk to him about it. Yes, at the University of New South Wales a very long time ago. And, of course, he used the term ironically because he was making a point that we did have good fortune, but it said nothing about us. In his view, we were led by very second-rate people. And we weren't very inventive and we weren't very creative and we didn't spend a lot of time actually reflecting on our circumstances. He was, of course, entirely right, but he was also exaggerating to make a point, which he did very effectively. That book has been remarkably successful and widely read, except that the phrase went into the language without the ironical overtones that he meant. And this is a bit disappointing for him, although he was pleased to have the phrase. We are a lucky country in that the relative standards of living are good. We're a lucky country in that we're overall prosperous. And we're a lucky country in that for most Australians, most of the time, life can be very good. But we have levels of poverty, which it surprises most people to hear, are above the OECD average. And that level of poverty hasn't changed really in a generation. It fluctuates a little, but not substantially. So there are a lot of Australians who grow up in difficult circumstances and who continue to live in difficult circumstances. And in that sense, they might reasonably say it's not such a lucky country if you're not born well.
Mm. You're listening to ABC Radio. This is Nightlife with Indira Naidoo. And my guest tonight on This Mortal Coil is Glyn Davis. He's the CEO of the Paul Ramsay Foundation and the former Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne. The Paul Ramsay Foundation works to end intergenerational poverty. And as Glyn mentioned, a lot of us would be surprised to hear that Australia ranks very poorly when it comes to how high poverty is amongst OECD countries. About 3.2 million Australians are living below the poverty line. Glyn, why are we doing so badly on that indice?
Well, this is goes to the core of not just the sort of moral and ethical questions, but the political questions about how we make these choices. We decide collectively how much we're prepared to tax ourselves in order to transfer payments and provide services to others. And that's a joint political decision. It's one we're all responsible for. In a democracy, we all get to make that call. And we have decided collectively on how generous we're agreeing to be. And that level of generosity is modest by international standards, but not insignificant. And I don't want to leave anyone with the impression that we don't look after people or provide some basic and important services. We do. But the level of transfer payments and other support we give still leave, as you rightly say, about 3.2 million Australians living below the poverty line. That includes 750,000 children. And you'll recall the famous No Child Will Be Left in Poverty promise made in the 1980s
By Bob Hawke,
and never achieved, and that remains the case. So we as a nation haven't wanted to change the balance here between what we're willing to tax ourselves and what we're willing to pay to others, and while we don't change that balance, then you'd expect these outcomes.
You mentioned that this poverty becomes intergenerational. It stays with families for generations. What are the chances of breaking the cycle if you're trapped in this poverty cycle?
So we have very explicit data on this from the Melbourne Institute, and it is quite sobering. So in our imaginations, I think we see ourselves as a land of opportunity, and we can all point to individual Australians who've grown up in very tough circumstances and yet have made it to be very successful, have very successful lives and careers. And those are just inspiring stories every time we encounter them. And they tend to frame how we think of life because they speak to values that we'd like to believe. We're meritocratic, and if you work hard and you've got the ability, you'll break through, and all of the things we cheerfully tell ourselves. But the Melbourne Institute data says pretty clearly that if you are born into poverty, and they call it extreme poverty, so they're talking about the poorest of the poor, then your chances of having an adult life not in poverty are very modest. For a male, about 83% of men or boys who grow into men out of poverty will remain poor through their lives. And for women, that's closer to 90%. Mm. So these are very disturbing figures. Now, we are talking about a relatively small portion of the population, but that makes it no less disturbing and no less compelling for wanting to do something. So for the poorest Australians, breaking out is very hard indeed. Not impossible. It's not that some people don't get to do it. And like most things in life, there's some element of chance and there's some element of hard work. But for many, indeed for most, it will be very hard to break out of the poverty that has marked their early years. And that's what the data shows. The longer you are in poverty in childhood, the stronger the probability that you'll be in poverty in adulthood.
Mm. And it becomes even worse, doesn't it, if you're from an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander background?
Yes, without doubt, the poorest Australians, or let me put it a different way, the most overrepresented Australians against lots of categories of disadvantage are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. Again, not everybody, not all, but a significant number, exacerbated by very high levels of incarceration. You recall that when Noel Pearson said that Indigenous people, Australian Indigenous people, were the most incarcerated peoples in the world, that was challenged. It was a sort of fact-checked argument. And the fact-check unit in the ABC, in fact, confirmed that is the case. There's no other group of people in the world more likely to go to prison. And you know, it's very hard to break out, to make a life, and to have the life you value, facing all of those constraints. But there are some good news stories here. There are some really impressive work being done by Indigenous people and then people who want to support them to try and break this cycle of disadvantage. And it might be worth touching on those.
Glyn, can we just talk about why a lot of Australians still have that Pollyanna version or vision of what Australia is, rather than the reality of this, endemic poverty situation that people, even with the greatest will in the world and determination, can't pull themselves out of? Why don't we look at the reality?
I think we could go back to the Donald Horne quote. I mean, his idea of the lucky country was that Australians felt fortunate and they felt that this was a country that offered opportunities and was sort of meritocratic. And that view runs deep. And in a sense, it's a view to embrace and to celebrate. The argument should be, let's make the reality match the view rather than the view is wrong. Because the view should be saying to anybody, you know, we should give you all of the collectively, we should give you all of the opportunities to have the life you want. And, you know, that could be in any direction. It's not up to society to tell you what you should value, but it is up for society to tell you what should be possible. There's a very influential line of thinking from the Indian economist Amartya Sen about capabilities, and he said that's the role of the state. It isn't to tell people how to live, it's to provide them with the health and the education and the social conditions that they can then make their own choices. And that seems to me a really valuable way to think about what we're trying to do here. Not change people's lives, not make decisions for them, but to make sure they can make the calls they want to make.
A lot of the ideas that you've been toying with and exploring, you've included in your book, On Life's Lottery. And one of the things, again, I think a lot of people would accept that life is a bit of a lottery, but we do as Australians think, oh, there are safety nets out there. If people fall into them, they'll pick you up, they'll protect you, they'll lift you back up. How effective are those safety nets? How is our welfare system working, Glyn?
One of the interesting experiences of the COVID year was the number of politicians who reflected on and even tried to live on the $40 a day that's available under the then existing safety net, and discovered that if you have to pay rent and food and look after children, that's just an impossible task. That was a reminder that although we do have a safety net, and that's a good thing, it isn't a generous one. It never has been. It's means tested. It's tough to get. And the terms of keeping it are quite tough. That there are consequences, and one of the consequences is those people living in poverty. Because the other big lesson of the COVID year was when that safety net was significantly lifted, and along the lines of JobKeeper and the other benefits that came through, we lifted hundreds of thousands of Australians out of poverty.
Yes.
And you will have heard those stories of people saying, well, for the first time I could go to the supermarket and actually do a decent shop for my family. I could get the school clothes we've not been able to get. It was such a moment because it reminded you how much a difference it makes to people's lives, even to lift them to the poverty line, which is what that did. It lifted people to the poverty line, but at least gave people enough money to live a decent life. And that's the test of a safety net. Better that it's there than not, but also it needs to be generous.
Yes, and concerning because the government is obviously talking about ending Job Seeker and Keeper in March, so everyone will go back again.
Absolutely, and so we need to keep having this debate. And it's a debate that's bound up with people's politics and their personal beliefs. You know, we all understand that. And your view about whether, you know, how generous a society should be to those who fall behind at what point you might create perverse incentives that discourage people from actually seeking to take decisions for themselves is a very legitimate question to ask. It's not like there's a golden answer and we can all agree, but it's a debate we need to have, and people need to be conscious of the consequences of the decisions we do make collectively.
I'm speaking to Glyn Davis, who is the CEO of the Paul Ramsey Foundation, about his book on life's lottery. When it comes to the chance that you're dealt when you're born, can you determine the path of your life the way a lot of us believe you can? But there are a lot of institutional blocks to people being able to pull themselves out of the poverty that they are born into often. You talk about passive welfare, Glyn. What do you mean by that, the passive welfare model?
Well, I'm really reflecting what others say. It's not an expression that I claim any credit for, but it's welfare that encourages you to be helpless. It's welfare that encourages you not to take responsibility for your own life. And the criticism which comes again from people like Noel Pearson and others is that the way we've constructed much of our, when we do have safety nets, is often they have, in a sense, left people helpless. They've taken away skills, they've taken away the dignity of work and opportunities to be in control, and they leave people helpless. It's not a happy story. It's not ever the intention, of course. No one sets out to do that, but you can see objectively that's what happens. And so for a lot of the movement around finding better ways of supporting people in disadvantage is all around trying to find ways of empowering and allowing people to lead rather than being told by government departments or charities what should and shouldn't happen. And so Noel Pearson, in using that expression, passive, the passivity that's involved is very focused on what does a more empowered collective view look like and how do we get there? And that's an important debate for us to have.
So are there any models of this happening where money is going to the project, to the community, the people that need it? They've got agency over it, that it's not being run from a bureaucracy in Canberra. Do you have an example where you feel it is working well?
Well, we touched earlier on Indigenous incarceration, which really is a big issue for the whole country. And it's exciting when you see people addressing this. And the project that I've done a lot of reading about is the Marangooka project, which is a just reinvest project in Western New South Wales, centred on Bourke, the town of Bourke, which had for a while the highest rate of teenage Indigenous incarceration in the country, which is not a record to be proud of. What's impressive is a series of local leaders, Indigenous in particular, came together and said, enough is enough. What can we do to change this? They picked up a model from the United States called the Justice Reinvestment Model, which says if we can persuade authorities not to just put people in jail, but to work with us in finding alternatives, can we get them to commit that the funding that would have gone to jails comes back into the community to help different sorts of programs?
Right.
And that's the deal being offered. And in Bourke, for much of a decade, we've seen, starting with Indigenous organisations, but including the Berkshire Council and a series of other players, private foundations, and eventually the New South Wales government, all coming in and saying, well, how could you disagree with it? It's such an obviously good thing to do. How can we get involved? And these are slow projects to set up because you've got to lock in people along the way over time. And they're very difficult for government because you're saying to government, instead of you being the decision maker, we want you to be at the table contributing to the shared outcomes, but being willing to take the risk of being part of something that you don't control. And government finds that very difficult. So does charity, because charity also is used to being in control, and because money's tight, you're trying to be very careful about where the money goes. And these projects, therefore, have to build trust. They have to build a core organisation that can manage and deliver. They have to work with police and courts, so the role of government becomes very important. But what was impressive about this project is first they looked at some early wins, One of the simple ones was saying, well, why do young people get into trouble with the police? Well, often they get into trouble because they're driving unlicensed. And you then say, well, why don't they get driver's licenses? And it turns out that lots of Indigenous people don't have birth certificates. In fact, there's some 200,000 Indigenous Australians who don't have a birth certificate. Well, if you don't have a birth certificate, you can't get a driver's license. And if you can't get a driver's license, but you drive, you're almost inevitably going to end up in trouble. So one of the early interventions was simply a program to help local people get birth certificates and to get driver's licenses. And that's made a really big difference. They invested in Indigenous youth organisations to work one-on-one with young people at risk to help them think about their choices. And to the point where every morning now in Bourke, there's a conversation between the Indigenous youth organisations, the local police, the school principals and the Shire Council to say, well, what happened last night? Are the young people in trouble? How can we reach out and help? What can we do? And the focus for everybody is, you know, keeping young people out of jail. And to do that, you've got to have diversion, you've got to have choices, you've got to have encouragement to stay in school, and you've got to think about what are the causes that are keeping people out of the, you know, out of the pathway that would give them the future they want. It also involves very difficult questions around behaviour, and one of those really difficult questions was around domestic violence. And a group of Indigenous men led a large project to look at domestic violence in the community in Bourke and ask what they could do to change it, and that has had a very substantial impact on families and on people going into the justice system. It's not perfect, not everything works, but they've managed to nearly halve many of the rates of incarceration. They've managed to give lots of young people a better future than they might have had. And they have shown that community and government and police can work together on a better outcome.
That sounds very encouraging. Lots of positive outcomes there, Glenn.
Yeah.
And very often when we're faced with all these challenges we have in society, particularly to do with poverty, we often do look to government, whatever that means, to fix the problem. How much of it do you think is our individual responsibilities as citizens?
Well, I think we all play a role, and that's important. 80% of Australians give to charity every year, which is great, you know, just hugely encouraging. 80% is a big number. Millions of Australians donate their time to charities, so that lots of charities are reliant on volunteer labour. It's the core of what they do. It's why 2020 was so difficult because of COVID. But you think of everything from op shops through to Meals on Wheels through to service delivery. Volunteers are right at the heart of that. That says something wonderful about Australians and something about the big-hearted community that we have. So we can all contribute, and we can contribute in different ways depending on our means. But we also make decisions collectively through our democracy, and that's the part of this conversation that we need to have, and that is, what is the role of charities and foundations in trying to get to a better Australia, and how much do they have to engage with the political process in order to argue that? And that's a deeply contentious point, because, you know, the general view about charities is they have to stay out of politics, and certainly they have to stay out of partisan politics. I don't think that's in dispute. But when does a charity have to say, well, we can see the cause and we can see what would make a difference, but to go there would be to have a political argument, and we can't do that. That becomes the difficult choice for them.
And, of course, the longer we leave this, the wider that gap between rich and poor grows.
Yes, the Australian data is interesting on this. There is a gap, of course, as there is in every nation. I don't think it's particularly growing in Australia. Yes, there are a number of extraordinarily wealthy people, but I think the Gini coefficient data tells you that it's relatively stable, and indeed the pattern of distribution of resources across our community is remarkably unchanged over a very long time. So Australia's had pretty stable levels of taxation, pretty stable levels of government expenditure and investment, and so that plays through to a relatively stable set of outcomes. And, you know, in one sense, that's good. That shows you that policy works and can make a difference. But it doesn't change. And so you have to have this argument if you think that outcome isn't as good as it could be.
Mm. And of course, well, I mean, we haven't even dipped into it, but the housing market is certain to exacerbate all those experiences of poverty and wealth.
Absolutely. And homelessness is one of the strongest markers of disadvantage, because if you have, like not having a birth certificate, if you don't have a home, you don't have a stable address, you're not able to get a job, you're not able to engage in education in a sustained way. I mean, homelessness is an absolute marker cause of extreme disadvantage. And so, again, one of the great lessons of COVID was we found hotel accommodation for homeless people across the country.
Yes.
In order to deal with a public health emergency, we were able to deal with homelessness. And you'd hope that post-COVID, that the lessons of that will come home and we'll think hard about how to do it. Again, there's some great stories. There's some really fabulous work being done by Common Ground and others, but also some really interesting new social enterprises which are using commercial techniques to try and provide social outcomes, and housing is a key topic. The foundation I'm part of is, I've just funded an organisation in South Australia to provide 600 new apartments for people with disability. And that we're doing it through a sort of bond operation, and it's designed to produce a reasonable return for the investors and to produce this great social outcome. It's a wonderful experiment. I hope very much it delivers.
Yeah.
So there are new ways of thinking about how we deal with homelessness, but if we don't deal with it, we're not likely to deal with that group of people for whom life is very tough indeed.
Absolutely.
And as I said, life has generally started tough and stayed tough.
Well, if any good comes from what we learnt during COVID, it will, I think, at least be that where there is a will, we can deliver. I mean, just in my local community and the Wayside Chapel and a few other of the local charities were able to basically get all rough sleepers off the street, something a number of governments had said was impossible to do, but it was done, it was achieved. So at least I think that will show us that when our community, our society is committed to something, we actually can achieve it. So hopefully we can build on that, Glyn.
Exactly. It's one of the great lessons. I mean, there's lots of positives out of COVID and the experience of the community that are worth building on. So even a very difficult and sometimes disastrous experience nonetheless produces lessons about how the world can change. The other thing about COVID, of course, is it showed us the world is not fixed, that policies that have been in place for a very long time, we suddenly overturned. We just talked about homelessness. Think about universal childcare provision, which for the first time ever we suddenly embraced. It tells you the world can change, that there are different ways we can think about problems and making differences.
Mm. Great. Lovely to chat to you, Glyn. Thank you for joining us on Nightlife.
A great pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Glyn Davis, who is the CEO of the Paul Ramsay Foundation and the former Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne, talking to us about his book on life's lottery and ways that we can all start thinking differently about how to stop poverty, decrease that gap between the rich and poor, and truly make our country a lot more fair.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.